copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
The topic of tonight's webinar is the theological vision of Pope Francis. Pope Francis is certainly one of the most liked leaders in today's world. In 2014, Time magazine voted him Man of the Year, and his popularity is on the increase, especially outside of the Catholic Church, where he seems to be very popular in religious circles as well as in secular circles. In secular circles, including left-wing thinkers and LGBT movements, many seem to resonate with his apparent inclusivity and willingness to affirm all in spite of what one believes and how one behaves. With his insistence on mercy, love, and tenderness, Francis likes to make his message non-judgmental. But the question that we are asking ourselves is whether or not this attitude squares with the gospel. The fact that most people like the man, from Muslims to atheists, with many evangelicals in the middle, is in itself a question mark. How is it possible that a leader who claims to preach the gospel be a kind of a hero for all? We're going to ask these questions first by trying to understand where he comes from and trying to put together the three overlapping worlds that somehow combine in his person. Secondly, we'll be looking at four significant writings that he has been, three of them he has been writing since, or two of them he has been writing since becoming Pope, March 2013, and two previous writings, one who comes directly from his pen, and the other one is a long statement that was drafted when he was the chairman of the Latin American Bishops Conference in 2007. And these writings will give us a entry point into Francis's theological vision. And then we will be looking at three programmatic missions that he's been trying to achieve in his papacy. Three main goals, three main objectives that he's been given and he's been trying to accomplish. And then we will be looking at some challenges, especially for evangelical Christians, as they try to understand what he's saying and what he's proposing. So that's the basic outline of my talk. First of all, in order to understand the theological vision of Pope Francis, we have to understand his Jesuit identity. He is the first pope who is also a Jesuit. For the first time in Catholic history, we have a pope that comes out of the Jesuit order. And the Jesuit order is, its origins are very much linked with the 16th century Protestant Reformation. And Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Jesuit order, and a contemporary of John Calvin, and a student in Paris when Calvin was also a student there, he began this movement in order to learn the secrets of the success of the Protestant Reformation and to use them to fight against it or to try to stop its success. Basically, in doing two things. One, learning the secrets of theological and philosophical scholarship. Most priests in the 16th century, early decades, were theologically illiterate, and the reformers had an easy job to, relatively easy job to confront them. So Ignatius wanted priests, not only priests, but also lay leaders, princes, powerful people to be equipped from the scholarly point of view in order to respond to the challenges posed by the Reformation. And then secondly, he wanted his order to be profound, to be an order that would push and emphasize the need for spiritual profoundness and depth. So as to envisaging not so much a type of religiosity marked by external and formal traditions, but looking at ways of implementing an embodied form of Catholic spirituality. And the Jesuit order has tried to be faithful to this imprinting and its DNA in order to help the Catholic Church to recover from the challenges posed by the Protestant Reformation. Of course, Pope Francis is a smiling Pope, is a smiling Jesuit. He would never use, at least during his papacy, would never use harsh words against anyone and against Protestants. But history cannot be hidden and cannot be overcome. And although it's not the only element to take into account, we need to be reminded that we have a Pope that comes out of an order that was founded in order to fight against the spread of the Protestant Reformation. Maybe the methods and the tools are certainly different than those used in the 16th century, in the 17th century, by the then the Jesuits of the time. But the spiritual, theological, and programmatic DNA is certainly part of his own personality. Secondly, he is a pope that has chosen a very programmatic name, Francis. The 12th and 13th century saint of the Christian Church, a Jesuit pope claiming or wanting to be referred to the heritage and the tradition linked to Francis of Assisi. And Francis of Assisi is related to an idea of the Christian life lived out in poverty, frugality, simplicity. And so the Jesuit identity of Pope Francis is combined with the desire of appearing as advocating for a poor church, rediscovering, relaunching the plan and the program of Saint Francis of Assisi. The first time that a pope has ever chosen the name Francis. And as a matter of historical fact, we have to remind that although I personally highly admire the memory of Francis, but his theological program was not so much to call for a renewal of the church, wanting the Pope of his time and the leadership of the church of his time to rediscover gospel values and truths. On the contrary, he only wanted the church to approve his rule for his group of friends. And when confronted with the possible threat that his rule would pose to the church, to the then rich and powerful church, Francis immediately made it clear that his program was not to challenge the way in which the leadership of his church then was living out its Christianity. He only wanted the Pope to sign the rule in order for his little group to discover and live according to poverty and simplicity. His contemporary, Peter Valdus, having the same or similar biography, being a rich businessman, selling everything and giving it himself to the preaching of the gospel, had a very different approach than Francis, and he would also challenge the leadership of the church. And Peter Valdus was persecuted, Francis was accepted because he was not perceived as a threat. So as he speaks about poverty, as he speaks about simplicity, he certainly applies these values to his own personal life. But as far as changing the attitudes, the practices, the values of the church, that remains to be seen. And even the recent new round of VatiLeaks, that is the spreading out of private information about the banking system, the real estate exchanges, and the finances of the Vatican, this new round of VatiLeaks shows that there is a difference between practicing poverty on a personal level and yet not being able to change structurally the way in which a powerful, rich institution is dealing with the issues of money and richness. The third overlapping world that Francis comes from is, of course, Latin America, Argentina. He's the first pope who is a Jesuit, the first pope to have chosen the name Francis, the first Latin American pope. Of course, his parents were not Latin Americans, they were Italians, but he was born and he has been living in Latin America since his boyhood. And he considers himself as coming from the end of the world, if seen from a Eurocentric perspective. And the Latin American soul, the Latin American attitude, the Latin American personality comes out every day, in any instance, in every speech, in every behavior, tends to be less interested in theological precision, is much more interested in developing relational ability to interact with people, is less of a scholar, more of a facilitator and a social being. So we have to combine these three worlds that together form the story, the biography, the soul, the heart of Pope Francis. Then we have to look at four significant writings. As I already mentioned, he is not a theologian, although he has never obtained a PhD in theology in his career. He has had a difficult scholarly career, beginning programs, never ending a postgraduate degree. And so once he was voted as the new pope, most people looked around to see what he had written in his past years, and the search was very difficult because there was just one single book that he had authored, and that we will be looking at it later. But although recognizing that he, unlike Ratzinger, that had a whole library made of his books, Bergoglio didn't have a single book appearing on his personal library. But that doesn't mean that he has not spread out seeds, and there are no hints about what he believes in terms of his theological vision. One important document that he certainly contributed significantly in shaping it was the Aparecida document, 2007. Aparecida is a Marian shrine in Brazil. The story is about this little statue of Mary being discovered by a group of poor fishermen, and out of that discovery, a whole cult developed, and then the big shrine of Aparecida was eventually built. And nowadays, Aparecida is the third Marian shrine most visited in all the whole world. In 2007, the Latin American bishops gathered together, and at the end of their conference there, they issued this document, the Aparecida document, which basically advocates for what technically can be called the theology of the people. And the theology of the people is one of the streams that Pope Francis is always referring to in his speeches, in his writings. The theology of the people, unlike the scholarly theology coming from the universities, is the theology that, instead of coming top down from the universities to the people, comes bottom up. Is a theology that doesn't really want to teach the people or to direct the people, but wants the people to set its own teaching, to allow the people to express their concerns and to respond to the concerns of the people. It's a bottom-up type of theology, very different from the more scholarly, top-down, magisterial type of theology that we are more used to in Europe. It's a theology that takes on board the desires, the concerns, the issues, the problems of the people, and having as its main reference point not so much the tradition of the church, not so much the biblical books of the Bible, not so much canon law, but it has as a main reference point the desires of the people. So that explains why Pope Francis is not so much a theologian as we are used to understand the theological task here in Europe. Certainly is not a scholar, certainly is not someone who speaks out of a chair. He is an advocate of the theology of the people. And that's why he always tries to affirm people, tries to see the positive side in people's lives, and tries to give affirmation to whatever the people around him is saying. Aparecida is also a document that blends this theology of the people with the Marian cult of the Aparecida shrine. So there is a combination of bottom-up theology and Marianism, folk Marianism, all combined together. And Marianism is an indicator of the theology of the people, because the people want a model and look for a model in Mary. So theology needs to give it to the people, and needs to be willing to support Marianism as well as other cults of the saints, because the people want it. The people want it. And so the church needs to follow basically what the people is looking for. The second important writing is the only book that Francis has ever written before becoming Pope. And it's a little book of a series of lectures that he gave in 1985 in Argentina on the history of the Jesuits. There are four lectures put together in a book form, republished in 1995 in Barcelona, Spain, and eventually republished after he has become Pope, in Italian, in Spanish, and I was told that translations in other languages are on their way. Basically, in these lectures, Bergoglio comes out as a very different character than we are used to see after he has become Pope. Here, in evaluating the history of the Jesuits, he clearly relate the beginnings of the Jesuits to the task of responding to the Protestant Reformation. And the Protestant Reformation is read in very, very, very negative terms. Luther is the heretic who has introduced the seeds of all evils that eventually developed in the West. The seeds of heresy, the seeds of subjectivity, the seeds of splitting together the unity of Europe, the unity of the people, and polarizing society, cutting the poor people from their traditions, their dear ones, in the dead ones, and introducing all kinds of evils that eventually developed in the West. And Calvin, according to this reading, is even worse, because he introduced, not only was he a heretic, he was also a schismatic, splitting the church, splitting society, splitting men's heart, and then even worsening what Luther had introduced. So here we find a very different type of man arguing very negative words and assessments against the Reformation. And although this book has been republished even after Bergoglio has become Pope Francis, with new forwards, he apparently has not considered it right to revise or review or even retract some of his very negative assessments. The great Saint Augustine, at the end of his life, he wrote the Retractationes, admitting some mistakes that he had done. But Pope Francis, although he smiles to Protestants, although he smiles to evangelicals, is very affirmative, seems to be very affirmative, but we have to remind that in his biography, the only written book that he has ever published is a very anti-Protestant book. And finally, the third document is his first apostolic exhortation. The same year when he was elected as Pope Francis, he came out with his Evangelii Gaudium, the joy of the gospel, calling the Catholic Church to a missionary conversion, to an outwarding attitude, to a change of mindset from the maintenance mood to a missionary outlook. And here Francis does its best in employing, using a kind of language that seems like an evangelical type of language, using words as gospel, mission, joy, missional, words that are very similar, very dear, very close to the evangelical vocabulary. And many evangelicals have understood these words, this document, as being a watershed in present-day Roman Catholic magisterial teaching. Now, a closer look at this document will, on the contrary, show that the convergences in the use of language is certainly significant. But the homework that needs to be done is a homework about interpreting and making sure that we understand what he's talking about. And I don't have here time to go into a detailed critique of the Evangelii Gaudium. Certainly is a very powerful document calling the Catholic Church to change the mindset. But I'm not sure that this joy of the gospel speaks about the biblical gospel and speaks about the joyful response to the gospel itself. This gospel seems to be a universal type of message that is already present in peoples of other religions, already present in every person, already present in those who do not believe, and the call of the church is to get out there and affirm everyone, hoping that in affirming everyone, the gospel that is already there will eventually develop and leading the people closer to the sacramental fullness of the joy of the gospel. The last significant writing is an encyclical, so a higher document than the exhortation, the highest document that a pope can actually produce, an encyclical, Laudato Si, quoting Francis on the ecological crisis and the Catholic vision for responding to this crisis. And I plan to give another webinar in March on this document. It's very complex. It would be difficult to summarize it in two sentences. Perhaps it needs a more careful reading, and certainly is a very, it has a great breadth of thought and vision, and we need to do our homework in order to assess what Pope Francis is saying in terms of these ecological problems. But certainly he has he hit a very deep concern of the Western, even the Western secular mind, and so he's become even more popular, especially in certain progressive left-wing circles and in wide sectors of the public opinion. So it's worth reading it and analyzing it. Three programmatic missions that he was given, or he has been trying to implement and accomplish. First of all, a turnaround with regards to the past, the recent past of the Catholic Church. When he was elected, the Catholic Church was in deep crisis in many respects. The sexual abuse scandals, the financial scandals, the public opinion, the Western public opinion was so opposed to the Catholic Church that the Catholic Church felt the need to look for a turnaround strategy. And Francis is making any effort to show the discontinuity between the recent past and his own leadership. The second mission has to do with the fact that given that the West is a difficult place for the Catholic Church in recent decades and has become a very tough place to speak to and to deal with in recent decades, the danger for the Catholic Church globally is not only to lose the West for the time being, for this generation, but also to lose the global South, especially Latin America and some Asian and African countries. And so in the analysis that led to the election of Pope Francis, that analysis highlighted the need for the Catholic Church to concentrate not only on the West. That was the main mission of the previous Pope. Pope Ratzinger was a Western scholar trying to address the Western crisis and basically failing to do that. The mission of Pope Francis is to not to lose the global South, actually to preside over the continents where the future of the Roman Catholic Church lies: Latin America, African countries, and some Asian countries. And Pope Francis has been working hard to visit these areas of the global South and is about to go to another trip to Africa in 2 weeks' time, in order to make sure that these borders of the Catholic Church are not lost over against evangelicals, Pentecostals, and other groupings, religious groupings. So that's another important programmatic mission. And then thirdly, his mission has to do with showing that, unlike the Catholicities of his previous pope, of the previous popes, he wants to mark his own program with the Catholicity of mercy, making mercy the central piece of the Church's message and the Church's action. And the recent Synod of Bishops on the issue of the family, and especially the admission of the divorced and separated people to the Catholic communion was one instance in which this Catholicity of mercy, this desire to show mercy, was evident. And in 3 weeks' time, on the 8th of December, Pope Francis called for a new jubilee, a holy year when indulgences will be given to all those who will make a pilgrimage or do some other works of penance. And the overarching word defining the jubilee is, again, mercy, the desire to show mercy in every way possible. We should question whether or not this unilateral, one-sided reference to mercy is what the biblical mercy really means, if it's not compensated or accompanied by the reference to justice, sin, repentance, conversion. If the reference to mercy in itself, in and on itself, a legitimate way of using the biblical concept or practice or pattern of mercy, or whether or not is it a something that, again, looks like is a, the, using the similar word but lacks biblical content and replaces it with unbiblical elements mixed up with some bits and pieces of the biblical meaning. So there are challenges for evangelicals as they try to discern what is happening, and they're trying to understand what Pope Francis has been doing and is doing so far. I think that we could talk a lot about the challenges, and these will be challenges for even the next years ahead of us. And I think that basically we can frame our discussion using these main points. First of all, he has many acquaintances in the evangelical world and shows them affection and consideration. He is very approachable. He has many friends in Latin America who are evangelical Pentecostal pastors, and he's showing them kindness and affirmation. And I met some of these Argentinian pastors in Rome, coming to Rome, and one of them told me, you know, in within our circles of, you know, our pastoral circles, we always criticize one another. We always talk against one another. Here we have a Pope that actually speaks highly of us and affirms us. So there's a great attraction to this kind of attitude. He knows, secondly, and uses evangelical vocabulary much more than previous popes. Dear words to evangelicals like conversion, mission, are often used by Francis. The problem, I repeat it, is whether or not he understands these words in the same way as an evangelical would understand them. But that's exactly the question that is ahead of us. He knows and practices evangelical forms of spirituality, spontaneous prayer, for instance, less liturgical ways of praying, as well as combining these things with the traditional Marian types of spirituality and prayers. He combines, he knows different codes of spirituality, including the evangelical code or form. And finally, he has a vision of unity like a polyhedron, a figure whereby there can be multiple angles, multiple distances, multiple relationships, not a square, not a circle, but a polyhedron, a figure with many angles and allowing everyone to remain where he or she feels to remain, but at the same time connecting the different parts and not apparently squeezing them in an already given form of unity. So that is also attracting, apparently is saying that in order to be united, we should remain who we are. And remaining who we are, we can then develop stronger relationships. So apparently he's not sending the message, come back to the fold, come back to Rome. He's saying we can be different as we are, and yet at the same time, we have to find a way to express, to value, to implement our unity. And that is also a new challenge for evangelicals. We have to process this kind of language and vision. Ultimately, I think we can summarize the challenge for evangelicals in a simple question with two possible answers. On the one hand, Pope Francis is pushing evangelicals to accept the idea that there can be an evangelical wing of the Roman Catholic Church, of a Roman Catholic Church further globalized, less institutionalized, without losing any of its part, but nevertheless looking forward. There can be a room, space for an evangelical wing that doesn't question the structure of Rome, the system of Rome, the theology of Rome, but finds its niche within it. That's one. That's the kind of proposal that Pope Francis is presenting to evangelicals. Or, receiving this proposal, should evangelicals remain committed to being a radical witness to the gospel, which refuses whole heavily compromised versions of Christianity? And so, while being open to dialogue and to ways of cooperation whenever is possible in social, ethical issues, making it clear that the system as it is a heavily compromised form of Christianity that doesn't need further expansion. Instead, it's in need of a radical biblical reformation.
Thank you, Leonardo. Thank you for your courage to approach this sensitive but very important topic. Thank you for making things so clear. And thank you for your scholarship, but presented with a shepherd's heart also. And I'm convinced that all of us are challenged to go deeper, to think through